I mean, I want you to picture a scenario that happens to pretty much all of us. You're scrolling on your phone.
Oh, yeah. Constantly.
Maybe you're on the train
Oh.
or like waiting in line for a coffee,
Yeah.
and you see a link for an article you genuinely want to read.
Or a product you actually want to buy.
Exactly. So
Yeah.
you tap the link, and then you're just staring at a blank white screen, just that little blue progress bar, permanently frozen at the top.
Oh, the worst.
How long do you actually wait before you bail? I mean, 1 second, two, three.
It's funny because time completely distorts in that moment. Like in the physical world, waiting 3 seconds for a door to open is nothing.
Right, you wouldn't even notice.
But in the digital world, 3 seconds of a blank screen feels like an absolute eternity.
It really does. You just you tack the back button and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So today's deep dive is all about that frozen white screen.
Which is such a massive issue right now.
It really is. We are unpacking a comprehensive guide today titled Why Your Website Loads Slowly and How to Fix It.
And this is such a crucial topic.
Yeah, and our mission today isn't just to, throw around a bunch of technical jargon. We want to really look under the hood and understand the actual mechanics of why a website speed is basically your ultimate digital first impression.
Because that's exactly what it is.
Right. And we want to figure out how to practically fix it without you feeling completely overwhelmed by all the code.
Well, understanding those mechanics is just non-negotiable today. I mean, website speed has completely evolved.
How so?
Well, a decade ago, it was mostly just a vanity metric, you know, for developers trying to show off.
Like, look how fast my site is.
Exactly. But now it is the absolute backbone of user experience, search engine optimization, and ultimately whether or not a business actually converts a visitor into a paying customer.
Okay, let's unpack this because the stakes laid out in this source material are honestly kind of severe.
They really are.
According to the data here, 53% of mobile users will abandon a page if it takes longer than 3 seconds to load.
Just think about that.
Over half your audience, just gone before they even see your logo.
What's fascinating here is the massive gap between that user expectation, you know, that 3 second rule, and the actual physical reality of the internet right now.
Yeah, the reality is a lot slower.
Much slower. The source highlights this massive study by Backlinko. They analyzed over 208,000 web pages.
That is a huge sample size.
Right. And out of all of those, only 53.7% of websites actually meet Google's recommended benchmark for loading their main content quickly.
So basically, almost half the internet is currently failing the baseline test.
Exactly. And the data gets much worse when you isolate mobile devices.
So bad.
Yeah, the average mobile web page takes an astonishing 27.3 seconds to fully load.
Wait, 27 seconds.
Yep, compare that to 10.3 seconds on a desktop.
27.3 seconds. I mean, you could order your coffee, pay for it, and like put the change in your pocket in that time.
It's an eternity online.
Since we know the stakes are that high, the logical starting point has to be the foundation.
Yeah.
Like, where does the website actually live and how is it built?
Right. The absolute bedrock here is web hosting.
Okay.
If the server infrastructure is weak, it really doesn't matter how beautifully designed or, you know, perfectly coded the website is, it's going to struggle.
Because the foundation is cracked.
Exactly. The source breaks hosting down into a few tiers. You've got shared hosting for small sites, VPS for growing businesses, cloud hosting for high traffic sites, and then dedicated hosting.
And a lot of people just go with the cheapest option, right?
They do, and that poor hosting is frequently the primary bottleneck.
Reading through this, I kept thinking about shared hosting like living in a massive, poorly insulated apartment building.
That's a really good way to look at it.
Like you share the plumbing and the electrical with hundreds of other tenants,
That analogy holds up perfectly when you look at how a server physically operates. In a shared hosting environment, hundreds of websites are sitting on a single physical hard drive.
Wow, hundreds.
Hundreds, and they're all utilizing the exact same CPU and the same RAM.
So if one of your neighbors, like another website on that exact same server, gets a massive surge in web traffic because, say, one of their posts went viral.
Yep, your site speed tanks.
Because their site is just eating up all the shared processing power. It's like
Yeah.
your water pressure just drops to a trickle because they're taking a long shower.
Exactly. The server CPU is literally context switching. It's trying to answer hundreds of concurrent requests for all these different websites simultaneously.
That sounds exhausting for the server.
It is. So as a business grows, upgrading to a VPS, which is a virtual private server or cloud hosting, provides a partitioned environment.
So you get your own space.
Right. You get dedicated CPU cycles and RAM. Your site isn't fighting for breathing room anymore. And we can actually measure this delay.
Oh, we can.
Yeah. With a metric called TTFB. That stands for time to first byte.
Okay. Let's break that down. Time to first byte. What is the server actually doing during that specific window of time?
Well, when you tap a link, your browser essentially asks the server for the website.
Right.
The TTFB measures the milliseconds it takes for the server to acknowledge that request, do all of its internal processing, and then send back the very first byte of data.
So it hasn't even sent an image yet?
Nope, not at all. During that time, if you have a slow server, it's just struggling to route the request, maybe querying a bloated database, compiling the HTML code dynamically.
Basically scrambling to get its act together.
Exactly, before finally pushing it out the door. So if your TTFB is high, the server is bogged down before the visual download even begins.
So that's the foundation.
Right.
But even if you have a lightning fast server, you can still ruin your load time with the digital furniture you put inside that apartment.
Oh, absolutely.
And the biggest offenders mentioned here are images. The guide points out a very common mistake, uploading a massive, 4,000 pixel photo directly from a phone or camera.
Oh, I see this all the time.
Right, just to fill a space on the website that is only 800 pixels wide.
It is incredibly common, and the penalty for doing that is twofold.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, there is the raw bandwidth issue. You are basically forcing a mobile network to transmit 3 or 4 megabytes of data when 50 kilobytes would suffice.
Which takes forever on a bad connection.
Right, but the hidden penalty is the processing power.
Wait, because the phone receiving the image has to do all the heavy lifting to shrink it?
Exactly. The user's device has to download the massive file, decompress the image data into its limited RAM, calculate the bounding box on the screen, and then downsample millions of pixels on the fly just to render it at 800 pixels.
That sounds wildly inefficient.
It really is. And it drains the user's battery, too.
I see. So it's not just a pipe problem, getting it there. It's a processing problem once it arrives.
Precisely.
Well, the guide offers some pretty practical fixes for this. First, obviously, resize the images before you upload them.
Yes, please do that.
Second, compress them. They mention tools like Squoosh or Image Optim, but the third recommendation really caught my eye.
Which one was that?
Transitioning to modern image formats.
Yeah.
Like WebP or AVIF instead of your standard JPEGs.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of a difference does a file format actually make?
A substantial difference, actually. A standard JPEG compresses data in these rigid blocks.
Okay.
But formats like WebP and AVIF use advanced predictive coding.
Predictive coding. How does that work?
The algorithm basically looks at a block of pixels and mathematically predicts the color of the adjacent blocks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, meaning it only has to store the mathematical difference rather than the raw color data of every single pixel.
That is incredibly smart.
It is. It also strips out invisible metadata, so you get the exact same visual fidelity at a fraction of the file size.
That makes perfect sense. There's also this thing called lazy loading mentioned in the text.
Ah, yes. Lazy loading is great.
Instead of downloading every single image on a massive blog post the second the page opens, lazy loading tells the browser to just hold off.
Right, because modern browsers use something called an intersection observer.
An intersection observer.
Yeah, it essentially draws an invisible line just below the user's screen.
Okay, so just out of sight.
Exactly. The browser doesn't even ask the server for an image until the user scrolls down, and that invisible line intersects with where the image is supposed to be.
I mean, why force a user to download a heavy footer graphic they might just never scroll down to see, right?
Exactly. It saves so much bandwidth and processing power.
So, okay, if we have upgraded the hosting, we've mathematically compressed the images, and we are lazy loading them, the site should be lightning fast, right?
You would think so.
But the source says a site can still choke here, which kind of moves the problem from the overall size of the files to, the sheer volume of individual requests.
Yes. This introduces the concept of HTTP requests.
Okay, lay it on me.
Every single discrete element on a web page, every custom font file, every style sheet, every social media icon, and every marketing script requires a separate individual HTTP request to the server.
That sounds like a lot of requests.
It is. A typical modern homepage routinely triggers over 60 separate requests just to assemble the initial view.
Over 60. But let me push back on this for a second.
Go for it.
If I am sitting at home on a super fast fiber connection, or I'm like downtown on a strong 5G network, why do 60 requests even matter?
It's a fair question.
If the files are tiny, shouldn't a fast connection just inhale them instantly?
It really seems like it should. But the limitation isn't the width of your broadband pipe. It's the latency of the conversation.
Good conversation.
Yeah, for every single one of those 60 files, your browser and the server have to perform a complex handshake.
A handshake, like they're meeting for the first time.
Exactly, a TCP handshake and a TLS negotiation.
Walk me through that.
The browser says, hello, are you there? The server says, I am here.
Okay.
Then the browser says, let's establish a secure encrypted connection. The server verifies its security certificate.
Wow, that's a lot of chatting.
And all of this back and forth communication happens before a single pixel of that specific icon or font file is actually transmitted.
So multiply that conversational overhead by 60 or 70 files.
And the delays compound rapidly.
So what does this all mean for the user? I mean, it sounds like going to a restaurant, sitting down and asking for a glass of water.
Okay, I like this.
And the waiter says, I'm sorry. I cannot bring you a glass of water until the kitchen has completely finished cooking your entire 5-course meal.
Yes. That analogy perfectly describes a specific technical bottleneck called render blocking CSS and JavaScript.
Render blocking sounds bad.
It is. When a browser loads a web page, it reads the HTML code linearly, right, from top to bottom.
Okay.
If it encounters a large JavaScript file linked in the header, the browser literally stops building the visual page.
It just gives up.
It halts the parsing process to download, read, and execute that script. Because, you know, the script might contain instructions that alter the layout of the page.
Leaving the user staring at that frozen white screen we talked about earlier.
Exactly. The browser is refusing to serve the immediate, necessary visual content because it is obsessed with processing background instructions first.
So the kitchen is holding up the water. The fix for this, according to the guide, is prioritizing above-the-fold content.
Right, the stuff you see immediately.
You configure the site to load the CSS required for that immediate visual area first and defer the non-essential background scripts until after the user can actually see and interact with the page.
Which brings us to a massive source of those background scripts.
Oh, yeah. Third-party marketing tools.
Yep. Google Tag Manager, Facebook Pixels, Hotjar Analytics. Those customer support chat widgets.
The ones that pop up and ask if you need help.
Those exact ones.
Yeah.
Individually, these tools provide valuable data or functionality. But businesses have a terrible habit of adding a new tracking tool every quarter and just, well, never auditing the old ones.
The digital clutter just piles up in the background.
And every single one of those tools injects external JavaScript into your site, forcing the user's browser to make even more HTTP requests.
And to servers you don't even control.
Exactly. Processing more code before the page finishes loading. So a ruthless audit is required here.
Ruthless, I like it.
If a tool isn't actively generating revenue or vital insights, it just has to be deleted.
Okay. Assuming we've audited the code, we've minimized the requests and optimized those images, we still have to confront the literal laws of physics.
The laws of physics always win.
Specifically, the geographic distance the data has to travel.
Mm.
But before we map out global routing, I really want to talk about browser caching.
Oh, caching is magic.
It really feels instantaneous when it works. You visit a site, it takes a second to load, but you go back the next morning and it appears instantly. How is the browser pulling that off?
It comes down to local storage. When browser caching is enabled via specific server headers, the user's browser saves static assets like the company logo, the main CSS style sheet, and structural images.
Where does it save them?
Directly onto the physical hard drive of their phone or laptop.
Oh, so the next morning, it doesn't even have to ask the server for those files?
Not at all. It checks its local disk first. The browser says, hey, I already have the logo from yesterday, and the server told me it's valid for 30 days.
That's so smart.
It retrieves the file from local memory in milliseconds, bypassing the network entirely. It drastically reduces the workload on the host server and eliminates network latency for returning visitors.
Okay, that handles the returning visitors perfectly. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, for a first-time visitor, data is physical. Right.
Very physical.
It is literal light traveling through fiber optic cables under the ocean.
Yep.
So if a website is hosted on a server in London, but a user is trying to load it from Sydney, Australia, that data has to physically travel halfway across the globe.
And the speed of light is fast, obviously, but it is not instantaneous.
Right.
That physical distance introduces unavoidable latency. Remember those TCP handshakes we discussed earlier?
The hello, are you there conversation.
Exactly. They take significantly longer when the signals have to bounce across transoceanic cables. And this is where a CDN, or content delivery network, becomes essential.
So how does a CDN actually bypass geography?
By creating edge nodes.
Edge nodes?
Yeah. A CDN copies your static website files and distributes them across a massive network of servers located in data centers all over the world.
So they're everywhere.
Right. So when that user in Sydney types in your web address, specialized routing automatically connects them to the closest physical CDN node, perhaps one sitting right there in Sydney.
Oh, wow.
They download the heavy assets locally, which slashes the geographic delay.
The guide recommends CDNs highly for e-commerce sites, software companies, or really any platform with a global audience.
It's a must-have for them.
But even if the data reaches the device instantly from a local edge node, we still have to confront what kind of device is actually receiving it, don't we?
We do. We have to circle back to the mobile reality,
which connects directly to that daunting 27.3-second average mobile load time we mentioned at the start.
It really does.
The source makes a fascinating point here about the disconnect in the design process.
Yeah, the developer's environment.
Right. A developer is often sitting at a desk looking at a massive 4K monitor connected to a dedicated fiber optic internet line.
It's a pristine setup.
They build in these gorgeous animations and complex JavaScript layers.
Yeah.
And it looks incredible in their controlled environment.
Of course it does.
But they're completely insulated from how it feels on a mid-range smartphone connected to a congested 4G network.
Exactly. And the processing architecture of a mobile phone is fundamentally different.
How so?
Well, mobile CPUs aggressively throttle their own performance to manage heat and preserve battery life.
Oh, so they slow themselves down on purpose.
Yes. So a heavy JavaScript animation that runs beautifully on a desktop processor will cause a mobile device to just freeze up. And Google is acutely aware of this disparity.
Which is why they introduced mobile-first indexing.
Right.
That's exactly why. Google essentially navigates the web using automated bots that masquerade as smartphones.
They pretend to be phones.
Yep. Google evaluates your website's performance, content, and structure based exclusively on how it renders on a mobile device.
Wow, so desktop doesn't even matter to them.
Barely. If your site is lightning fast on a desktop but a slow, unreadable mess on a phone, your search engine rankings will just plummet across the board.
That's a huge shift.
The mandate is clear. You have to design, build, and test for the mobile experience first.
Okay, so understanding all these mechanisms behind hosting, image rendering, script execution, and mobile processors, that gives us the theory.
Right, the background knowledge.
But if someone listening wants to actually diagnose their own specific website, they can't just guess. They need hard data.
They need a diagnostic toolkit that reveals those invisible bottlenecks we've been talking about.
And the source lists several excellent free tools to do this. Google PageSpeed Insights is kind of the baseline, right?
Definitely the starting point.
It gives a score out of 100, but the real value is the itemized list of problems. Like, it tells you exactly which images need compressing or which scripts are blocking the render.
It's very specific.
Then there's Lighthouse, which is built directly into the Chrome browser. That one audits performance alongside accessibility and SEO.
And those tools are great for giving you the Google perspective. But to truly understand the mechanics of the load process, you need to visualize it.
Oh, absolutely. This is where GT Metrics really shines.
Oh, I love GT Metrics.
The waterfall report in there is incredibly revealing. It displays this cascading visual graph of the exact chronological order in which every single file on the web page loads.
It's amazing. You can physically see the thin lines representing the DNS lookup and that TLS handshake we talked about, followed by the thick bars representing the actual data download.
Yeah, you can literally point to the screen and say, look, this one specific third-party marketing pixel stalled for 2 seconds and held up the entire rest of the page.
It removes all the guesswork.
It really does.
There is also Web Page Test, which allows you to simulate loading the site from specific global data centers using specific connection speeds.
Oh, so you can test if your CDN is actually working for that guy in Sydney.
Exactly. It validates your global setup.
Now, when running these diagnostics, the reports are often flooded with acronyms, but the guide narrows the focus to what Google officially calls its core web vitals.
These are the big ones.
These are the three specific metrics that actually impact your search rankings. Let's dig into the mechanics of these three. The first is LCP, or largest contentful paint.
Right. So LCP measures how quickly the single largest visual element in the user's viewport completely renders.
Like the main banner or something.
Exactly. It might be a hero image, a background video, or even just a massive block of headline text.
Mm-hmm.
Google's benchmark is that this element must fully render in under 2.5 seconds.
And if it doesn't?
If the LCP is delayed, the psychological effect is that the site feels broken. Because, you know, the main thing the user actually came to see is just missing.
That makes total sense. Okay, the next vital is INP, interaction to next paint.
This one measures responsiveness, and it ties directly back to our earlier conversation about heavy JavaScript.
Right, the mobile CPU freezing up.
Exactly. Let's say a user taps a menu button. INP measures the millisecond delay between that physical tap and the website actually executing the visual response.
So if the browser is too busy executing a massive background script, it literally cannot process the tap.
Yes. The main thread of the CPU is blocked. A good INP score is under 200 milliseconds.
It's fast.
But if the main thread is occupied, the button tap registers a half second late. And what does the user do?
They assume they missed the button.
Right. So they tap it three more times in frustration, and the interface just becomes a chaotic mess.
Oh, man. We've all experienced that rage-quitting moment.
It's the worst.
Okay. The final core web vital is CLS, cumulative layout shift.
Right. This measures visual stability, and the benchmark is maintaining a score below 0.1.
I really want to understand the mechanics of a layout shift. Like, why does a page suddenly jump around while it's loading?
It almost always comes down to missing dimension attributes.
Dimension attributes.
Yeah. The browser reads the HTML and starts painting the text on the screen, right? Meanwhile, it's downloading an image in the background.
Okay.
But if the developer didn't explicitly declare the width and height of that image in the HTML code, the browser doesn't know how much blank space to reserve for it.
Oh.
So when the image finally finishes downloading, the browser has to violently shove all the text down to make room for it.
Causing the user to lose their place in an article?
Yep.
Or worse, causing them to accidentally tap an ad instead of the link they were actually aiming for.
It is a profoundly frustrating user experience, and Google heavily penalizes layout shifts because of it.
So the targets are clear. LCP under 2.5 seconds, INP under 200 milliseconds, and minimal layout shifts.
Those are the goals.
But the guide explicitly calls out a trap that people fall into here. Chasing the perfect 100 out of 100 post speed score.
Yeah, striving for a perfect lab score is generally a huge misallocation of resources.
Why is that? I mean, isn't 100 always better than an 85?
Not necessarily, because a lab test is an artificial environment. Google cares far more about CRUX data, which is the Chrome User Experience Report.
What does that measure?
It measures the actual real-world speeds that human beings are experiencing on your site out in the wild.
Oh, so actual people, not bots.
Exactly. Many of the most robust, highly functional, and profitable platforms on the internet do not score a perfect 100 in a lab environment.
That's a relief to hear.
The objective is to pass the core Web Vitals thresholds and deliver a seamless, fast experience to a human user, not to just appease a diagnostic algorithm.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Looking at the overarching philosophy presented by Credify in this text.
Yeah, their take on it is great.
Website speed is fundamentally not a one-and-done project. You don't just, you know, optimize the code on a Tuesday and assume it stays fast forever.
Right. A website is a dynamic ecosystem. As it evolves, entropy sets in.
Entropy, yeah.
The guide points to database bloat as a prime example of this.
Database bloat.
Yeah. So if you write a blog post and revise it 20 times, your database might be permanently saving all 20 legacy revisions.
Just sitting there taking up space.
Exactly. Over years, that database becomes sluggish, which slows down the TTFB we talked about earlier.
The guide also mentions redirect chains as another form of entropy.
Oh, those are sneaky.
Like you move a page, so you set up a redirect. A year later, you restructure the site and redirect that page again.
It just stacks up.
Suddenly, a browser has to hop through three invisible server redirects just to find the final URL. Small inefficiencies just compound over time. It requires consistent digital hygiene.
It really does. But if a listener is feeling daunted by the prospect of auditing databases or configuring CDNs, the source provides a really clear starting line.
The quick wins.
The 5 to 30 minute quick wins.
You can literally execute these today. Route your images through a free compression tool before uploading them.
Huge difference right there.
Toggle on the lazy loading feature in your platform.
Yeah.
Enable browser caching. And honestly, simply go into your dashboard and delete the plugins, themes, and tracking pixels you haven't even looked at in 6 months.
Just clean house.
Those basic mechanical adjustments will tangibly improve the load time.
Which is great, but this raises an important question, something that builds on all these mechanics of bandwidth and scripts that we've discussed.
Okay, what's that?
In a world where every new marketing plugin, every AI chat widget, or every shiny new tracking pixel promises to increase your sales.
Right, they all promise the moon.
Exactly. Is there a tipping point where the actual speed penalty of adding that new feature costs you more customers than the feature itself brings in?
Oh, wow. That is a fascinating way to look at it. Yeah. We are so focused on adding features to get sales, we might be tanking the very speed that keeps people on the site in the first place.
It's a delicate balance.
It really is. I highly encourage you, when you have a free minute today, go run a quick Page Speed Insights test on your own site.
Just see where you stand.
Look at the waterfall report. See what is actually happening behind that blank white screen.
Mm.
Because as we've seen today, every single millisecond counts. Thanks for diving deep with us today.